You're listening to UPR Presents, and today we present a panel discussion. On Wednesday, October 23rd, Utah State University's Nora Eccles Harrison Museum of Art hosted Utah's Proving Ground, Aesthetics, Environment, and Politics of Dugway Proving Ground. It was an artist talk and panel discussion. It was held in USU's Performance Hall. The event complemented the exhibition currently on view at the museum titled Proving Ground by photographer David Maisel. Here's how that project is described at davidmaisel.com. An encounter with one of the most secretive American military zones, Proving Ground is David Maisel's investigation through photographs and time-based media of Dugway Proving Ground, a classified site covering nearly 800,000 acres in a remote region of Utah's Great Salt Lake Desert. Since its inception during World War II to the present day, Dugway's primary mission has been to develop and test chemical and biological weaponry and defense programs. After more than a decade of inquiry, Maisel was granted rare access to photograph the terrain, testing facilities, and other aspects of this deliberately obscured region of the American Atlas. Comprising aerial and on-site photographs made at Dugway, this body of work explores questions surrounding military power, national security, land use, and the limits of technology and human endeavor. The panel for this panel discussion was comprised of photographer David Maisel and author Terry Tempest Williams, along with Mark Brunson, environmental ecologist at USU, and Vincent Lydiard, chief of staff at Dugway Proving Ground. The moderator was Matthew LaPlante, a USU journalism professor and host of Undisciplined, a program on Utah Public Radio. The exhibition Proving Ground opened at Nora Eccles Harrison Museum of Art on the USU campus in mid-September. It's on display through December 14th. For more information on Proving Ground and USU's Nora Eccles Harrison Museum of Art, you can go to artmuseum.usu.edu. The artist talk and panel discussion were sponsored by the O.C. Tanner Foundation, the USU College of Science, USU S.J. and Jesse Quinney College of Natural Resources, USU Kane College of the Arts, Utah Public Radio, and University Inn. Now on UPR Presents, we present a panel discussion titled Utah's Proving Ground, Aesthetics, Environment, and Politics of Dugway Proving Ground.
You guys, this is a motley crew, but already, as you might have noticed, there is a significant amount of overlap in what these folks do, what they study, what they create, and what they think about. And today we're going to explore those intersections through the lens of Dugway. I'm going to start with an individual question for each of you, and then once we're done with that, I'm going to ask some questions of the group, and I'm going to let you guys have at each other. But let me start with Vincent. You've been with, or you've been with the Army, or working with the Army, or working for the Army at Dugway since 1997. That was the year, by the way, that you got your master's degree at Utah State University. So welcome home.
Yeah, thank you very much, Utah State University.
I would like you tonight to start by divulging a secret about one of the most secretive places in the world. And here's what I'd like you to tell us. What's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen at Dugway?
My wife on my way coming home.
That is a good answer. What is the second most beautiful thing you've ever seen at Dugway?
You know, that's a really good question. So I got to give a little caveats here. During that entire time, part of that time, I was actually a contractor. So I worked for another company that had a contract with the United States Army. And yes, I am the United States Army Chief of Staff for Dugway Proving Ground. But my comments tonight are mostly going to be, what you're going to hear are my own personal comments and opinions, not necessarily the policy of Dugway Proving Ground or the United States Army.
So the Army's official policy is not that your wife is the most beautiful thing at Dugway.
As much as I'd like to make that so, that is my own personal opinions. Dugway Proving Ground, the second most beautiful thing I've seen there, that's a tough question. I think it has to be, that is a really tough question. You know, I think one of the things that is I'm constantly amazed at the beauty that I get to enjoy. I'm constantly amazed at being able to see the dedication of good people. They don't only work there, they live nearby, or they live in Salt Lake or Tooele. And there seems to be a deep passion or they can't seem to figure out that they'd get paid more if they worked somewhere else. But nevertheless, they are deeply committed to what they do, and they firmly believe that they're making a positive difference in the world. Many of them are there trying to do their part to save lives. Some of them are there because they have family members or their previous members of the military. But they each bring something unique. And for me, the beauty is in the environment, and the beauty is seeing the contributions of a group of people united for one common good.
David, you got to see this firsthand, and we were chatting a little bit before about how impressed you were with the people that you met, and how, even though you came from very different places and might have suspected that you had very different perspectives on the world, you came to find a kinship with a lot of these people. You chose this place, Dugway, to explore the ways in which the natural world meets the human moderated world. I'm wondering, what do we stand to discover in these sorts of liminal spaces?
So like a liminal space is a space that's kind of a threshold environment. And I think the Spiral Jetty is a great example of that, actually. I mean, it's already 50 years old, but I think it's still incredibly relevant. And if I use that as an example, it is like being in a labyrinth. You know, you're if you're walking out on the spiral, you're passing where you've been, you're passing where you're going to be, and that gives us an opportunity to look back in time and to understand our perspective historically, but also to look forward in time. So that, I think, that kind of liminal space, maybe Dugway again could be considered a liminal space, or the approach I've taken to it. If we learn how to understand our place in time, humanity's place in time, I think we stand to gain a lot from it. There's a really remarkable book by this geologist, Marcia Bjornerud, and she talks about what we could learn from a greater understanding of geologic time and how that might help us kind of save ourselves and save the world. So maybe that's what a liminal space could potentially do, is kind of permit us to understand our place in time.
A little bit of perspective.
Yeah.
Terry, I want to pose a similar question to you, because your work often centers on the interface of where human society meets the natural world, particularly here in Utah, this state that you have called a beautiful violence. And I understand that you brought something to read. Can you read that for us now?
Yeah, and I just want to say what a privilege it is to be here. With David, the courage and power of your work, for those of us who are Utahns, you allow us to see our place differently. Mark, to be able to interpret from a biological standpoint what's at stake. And Vincent, I have just loved our time together. You know, we wouldn't get an opportunity to speak, and I have learned so much from your science background and your commitment to keeping us safe. And Matt, thank you for your work. As a journalist, as a person with edge that allows us to go deeper. And I really have to say to Katie Lee, to have an exhibit like this in Utah, in place, I think is heroic. And I just honor Utah State for having the kinds of conversations we need to have in this state. And I would like to honor you. And this is a piece maybe a minute and a half long, two at the most. And I think it's, as a Utahn, realizing how often we compartmentalize and don't see the whole. And my debt is large to photographers like David, like Emmett Gowan, who at this very moment is having his opening in New York City regarding the Nevada test site. So I think to know that David's mentor, my mentor, you know, we're all talking about these things to find greater transparency, greater understanding to what it means to be human. The American landscape is under assault by an administration that cares only about themselves. Working behind closed doors, they are strategically undermining environmental protections that have been in place for decades and getting away with it. In practices of secrecy, in deeds of greed, in acts of violence that are causing pain. Like many, I have compartmentalized my state of mind in order to survive. Like most, I have also compartmentalized my state of Utah. It is a violence hidden that we all share. This is the fallout that has entered our bodies, nuclear bombs tested in the desert. Boom. These are uranium tailings left on the edges of our towns where children play. Boom. The war games played and nerve gas stored in the West Desert. Boom. These are the oil and gas lines, frack lines from Vernal to Bonanza in the Uinta Basin. Boom. This is Aneth and Montezuma Creek, the oil patches on Indian lands. Boom. Gut bear's ears. Boom. Cut Grand Staircase Escalante in half. Boom. And every other wild place that is easier for me to defend than my own people and species. Boom. The coal and copper mines I watched expand as a child, Huntington and Kennecott. Boom. The oil refineries that foul the air and blacken our lungs in Salt Lake City. Boom. And the latest scar on the landscape, the tar sands mine in the Book Cliffs, closed, now hidden simply by its remoteness. Boom. Add the Cisco Desert where trains stop to settle the radioactive waste they carry onto Blanding. Boom. Move the uranium tailings from Moab to Crescent Junction, then bury it still hot in the alkaline desert, out of sight, out of mind. Boom. See the traces of human indignities on the sands near Topaz Mountain left by the Japanese internment camps. Boom. We are being told a treacherous story that says it is an individual's right, our hallowed state's right, to destroy what is common to us all. The land beneath our feet, the water we drink, and the air we breathe. Our bodies and the bodies of the state of Utah are being violated. Our eyes are closed. Our mouths are sealed. We refuse to see or say what we know to be true. Utah is a beautiful violence.
Mark, I apologize for making you
I was going to say, I didn't. Let's make this hard.
Terry uses the words to destroy what's common to us all. Before we jump further in this conversation, I'm wondering if you can give us, as an ecologist, some perspective on how much of the world we've destroyed. Maybe not destroyed, maybe altered. I'm not looking for a number here so much as a sense of whether there's anything even resembling pure nature anymore in this world, in the way that nature is often defined as being a system that is unaltered by human activity?
With climate change, I would say no. You know, there is no place that has not been affected by human activity through the burning of fossil fuels and how that's affected our atmosphere and therefore processes down to the depths of the Mariana Trench or to the top of Mount Everest or to the most remote places that make Dugway look like next door neighbors. But I don't always think about it that way. You know, when I looked at, I came to the opening a month or so ago and of David's exhibit, and I looked at the photographs and I was struck by not only the patterns of the grids and the various places where there might be impacts or tests going on, but I was also struck by the resilience, the resistance of the land. So, you know, my eyes, as an environmental scientist, immediately went to those squiggly lines that you may have seen, which are essentially patterns left by the wind as it blows across the desert and is affected differentially by the shrubs. And I looked at those spots, you know, those pockmarks on the landscape. And you could think about that, you know, some of you may have looked at that and said, oh, wow, you know, is that, you know, sort of the remnants of explosions that occurred here? Well, no, what that was those are harvester ant mounds. You know, those are ants, you know, that, and there can be as many as 20 of these mounds in an acre of the Great Basin Desert, and they can be as big as 30 feet in diameter, and they've got these, you know, and the ants not only build their nests there, you know, and put these gravels on there that don't really support plants, but then they denude additional area around it, you know, probably as a defense mechanism to make sure that you know, predators can't sneak up on them so much. And so here we are in this place that is Dugway Proving Ground that has been altered because of the, you know, to protect Americans against the worst instincts of any humans. And here in amidst this, there are still large populations of kit foxes on the Dugway Proving Ground. There's things going on. And if there's environmental alteration, the worst is probably cheatgrass, which we brought from Central Asia and is now spread across the thing and is affecting the landscape in different ways. So that's probably not quite what you asked, but that was my answer.
That's the best kind of answer. I would like to give you all an opportunity to not quite answer this question as well. Dugway isn't just any man-made place. This is a place where the United States has tested chemical and biological weapons and developed defenses against weapons of these sorts. That can feel like and sound like can be scary, frightening. I'm wondering how we make sense artistically and how we make sense emotionally of the things that human beings have unleashed upon our world. Don't everybody jump in at once.
Well, I think the first step is to look and to examine, right? And I mean, I'm really appreciative of the access that I was granted to make this body of work at Dugway. It wouldn't have been possible without a lot of a tremendous long and complex series of emails and phone calls and things of that nature. But the bottom line is I was granted access, right? So by permitting me access, I mean, I have a lot of respect for that response and for the way that I was treated at Dugway. And I'm deeply appreciative of it. But I think the first step is for us to, by looking, to redefine what landscape is, right? You know, we think of landscape as our backyard or the school grounds where our kids play or maybe a national park. Maybe we get out to hike in the mountains, or on vacation we go to the beach, and that's how we think of landscape. But it's a much more complex series of sites than that. And I think we really are obliged to look at settings and to think about settings that we don't ordinarily occupy. So, you know, when you were saying how, you know, what areas are untouched. No area is untouched, mm-hmm. as you said. You know, I mean, 35 years ago, I photographed the Matanuska Glacier in Alaska. Well, it's basically disappearing now. And I have some figure in here from NASA's Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment, and it talks about the loss of 281 billion tons of ice per year between 1993 and 2016 from glaciers. So, you know, we need to look at these kinds of sites, right? We think about the desert, maybe like where Dugway is located, but we think about the desert as this kind of pure thing. It's not. I mean, I've been working in the Atacama Desert in Chile most recently, and that area, which is the highest and driest and most environmentally sensitive desert on the planet, is being rapidly transformed by mining for lithium, because we need lithium for our iPhones, and we need it now. We need it for our electric car batteries that are supposedly going to solve the problem of burning fossil fuels. So we need to expand what we let ourselves think about. It's that simple.
If we accept this notion that everything has changed, that everything has been changed by human activity, how do you all think about just the concept of nature?
I'll follow up a little bit on his comment as well, because, and kind of the first question you asked me, part of my constant amazement is the beauty, and I'll tell you what, the night sky at Dugway is fantastic. But the series of roads that David has captured, and I really enjoyed going and seeing that, particularly in the way that it's presented, because that's the perspective that most people who work there never get. You don't see Dugway from the air. You certainly don't see it in that kind of definition or in presented. And you know, maybe you're looking at Google Maps on your phone or something, but essentially nobody gets that kind of perspective. So that's kind of neat. There's some beauty in it. I have seen the series of roads. Now, Dugway's been around for nearly 77 years. Somebody at point had made these roads. Now the roads are much narrower. Mm-hmm. They're being reclaimed over time. They're changing, and they will continue to change. The past of Dugway, I can't really speak to. I can talk of the contemporary nature and what's been done there. Part of it is everything from, well, I've been able to hold a baby kestrel, because we're part of that kestrel project and banding those and working with those and the wildlife biologists that are there, but also the things that are done still out of doors for early detection, for providing detection of whatever that end goal might be, in supporting our warfighters, in supporting homeland security, in doing things that are ultimately used by the firefighters in our neighborhoods. And being able to provide a more immediate response and having better technology. Those differences are made not just in other regions of the world by warfighters, but they're being made in our communities by firefighters who now have better technology that they're able to use, and transitioning that information to them. That's exciting. And there's a beauty in that. There's interesting to see how what was created 77 years ago is changed over time. And where that constant movement goes. Things that were originally created with a mass of human labor, they're no longer relevant, or they're being used in a much more contemporary means. And certainly the bulk of human activity has shifted quite a bit.
You know, I think about the costs. The nature of our obsession with the military complex. And, you know, as a child growing up in Salt Lake City, and my cousin Lynn is here, our family's business is laying infrastructure. And so my grandfather spent a lot of time putting in gas lines, water lines to the Tooele Army Base and Depot, and our family has worked at Dugway. So you ask, what role does it have on our imagination? I remember being terrified as a child, knowing that across the ochres were all these chemicals. You know, were we safe? What was happening? Why didn't we talk about it? You know, I have to say, you know, what is the cost? I think there probably isn't one family here that hasn't experienced cancer. You know, in our family, 9 women in my family have all had mastectomy, 7 are dead, I believe, because of the nuclear testing. When you look at where that fallout was, I think any of us who grew up in Utah in 1968 remember close to 6,000 sheep dead. Why? We forget that. You know, I think being down, we're now talking about uranium mining in this state. I've been down and talked to Navajo families, the Diné, who, you know, 50,000 workers dead. These are not abstractions. This is not beautiful to me. This is, you know, David, you asked the question about what we demand from the lands of the American West. We're a dumping ground. And this concerns me. And what I want to know is, how can it be more transparent? And I appreciate the people who work there. You know, my brothers are cousins, my father, uncle, you know, these are working class people. It's how I've benefited. How do we, it's not us versus them, but how do we as American citizens make the determination of what we sacrifice for our safety, but also what is the health of not just our families and communities, but the health of the planet? And how can we be more transparent? How can we take the secrecy that silences us and in many ways kills us into a place of healing?
You know, one of the things that I just met Terry today, one of the things I appreciate is while we come from different perspectives, backgrounds, we have some unifying elements and the ability to visit, talk with you and develop a friendship there and be able to have those conversations, I think are important. And you mentioned something, and I've mentioned of my son, his greatest superpower is he asks questions. And I think asking questions, particularly we're at an academic institution, asking questions, that's the foundation of knowledge. Let's ask questions, let's ask the right questions. I would love an opportunity to sit down and eat lunch with each of you, and we'd have some delightful conversations, just the experiences that I've had and the things that I could relate and say, hey, you know what, here's the rest of the story. And there's a lot of mystery in what we don't know, and being able to understand it helps us to appreciate it better or come to a better now. Where do we go from here? So I really liked what she had mentioned about, you know, asking those questions. Where are we at? What are we doing? And again, my experience is certainly more contemporary, and so it's kind of hard for me to say, hey, the whys and the wherefores from past generations. But I am excited that exists quite clearly through a lot of what's done. I think people are recognizing there's a difference to be made, and they're working to make a positive difference. Some things that I had no clue of when I first arrived at Dugway Proving Ground, and then being able to see what's being done to make a positive influence. And we're one, if you will, one little gem in the overall map of Dugway Proving of Utah. Dugway Proving Ground is just one little part. And you mentioned there's the Tool Army Depot, there's the South area that's since essentially completed its activity, and there's so many other things. I'm interested in learning more about all of the other things that were introduced here today, but again, my ability to respond or talk about it for one little facet and asking questions, that's the path to knowledge.
If you just joined us, we are presenting on UPR Presents a panel discussion titled Utah's Proving Ground, Aesthetics, Environment, and Politics of Dugway Proving Ground. That was presented by the Nora Eccles Harrison Museum of Art at USU on October 23rd. We recorded this panel discussion as it originated from the USU Performance Hall. The panel for this panel discussion is comprised of photographer David Mazel, author Terry Tempest Williams, along with Mark Brunson, environmental ecologist at USU, and Vincent Lydiard, chief of staff at Dugway Proving Ground. The moderator is Matthew LaPlante, a USU journalism professor and host of Undisciplined on Utah Public Radio.
Terry, you talk about a changing landscape, a psychologically changing landscape as well. And when Mark, can you add to that? Because you mentioned earlier about the fact that there's nothing unchanged now and that climate change is really responsible for this sense that there's nothing unchanged. And I'm wondering, do you feel like over your lifetime that the psychological climate has shifted in response to the way that we now can't look at things as untouched?
I've been thinking about, as I've been listening to some of the discussion we've been having today, you know, we are thinking about humans as being somehow different from nature. You know, even though humans are, you know, biological organisms with, you know, we're transforming our environment to achieve our objectives just as the ants are transforming the environment to achieve their objectives. But we are different, you know, and so I think part of the way that we are different is that the way we think about our relationship with nature has changed over the years. You know, if you think about, you know, for millennia, you know, humans were, you know, given the imperative, to, you know, they were given dominion over the earth, you know, and then there was this reaction to it, which is, you know, almost like, no, humans are the problem, you know, humans are different, and you know, the world would be a better place if there were fewer of us, you know, which may be true, but I'm not volunteering. And and so, you know, but what I'm seeing now is when we think about the environment, I think there's more and more people that are trying to think about a partnership that acknowledges that humans have needs from their environment, but also acknowledges that there are other things here. And so, you know, to my mind, that, you know, that certainly is, it may not be the you know, the modal response from people in Utah, you know, certainly not in our legislature, but I think that I see that in my students, and I see that in the ways that natural resource managers are trying to solve their problems, you know, not so much let's transform, but let's, you know, let's figure out how to I'm not sure exactly, conform in a way.
I think it also comes down to what do we value? You know, there's such a paradox, I think, here in Utah in particular. We are so proud of, you know, Zion, Bryce, Canyonlands, Arches, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. all of our national monuments. And yet, if Bears Ears, for example, and yet if you just go a little bit off the highway, there's the largest capped uranium mine imaginable. You know, we don't see those things. And it's, I just wonder, what is it that we value, and at what point do we as citizens rise up on behalf of the open space of democracy? Do we want to be a sacrifice zone as Utahns? Are we passive? You know, and that's where I want to have the conversation, whether it's in the legislature or in our communities, that it's not just, we are not the only species mm-hmm. that lives and breathes here. You know, I look at that video, David, of the chemical cloud, the chlorine, and I think about the eagles. I think about all the birds migrating from Great Salt Lake. You know, what's the effect? And I appreciated you saying that you make sure when the winds are blowing and when they're not, and putting that mylar. You know, that I think is important pieces of information, so how we can work together. But I think we have to say, at what scale are we living at? And, you know, in a place like Salt Lake City, my brother lost half of his lung. He's out every day in the valley laying pipe. I didn't know there were three floors of people with lung diseases. We don't see that. So these are the questions I'm asking. What do we value as citizens? How do we become part of the conversation, not passive participants?
David, are you actively trying to generate those conversations with your art?
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I want the conversations to happen. I don't want the work to be so didactic that it tells you what to think. It's really important to me that I present things in an open-ended way. I'm very, I think, maybe even sometimes overly careful to work in that manner. But I want there to be dialogue and conversation and curiosity sparked by the work, and not just this project, but, you know, every project that I've made. Really, that's the goal. That's the goal. Yeah.
You've all had an opportunity, I think, to walk through David's exhibit. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I want to step away from context here for a moment, if possible at all, given the heavy nature of the context of this work. But I'd like to focus on aesthetics, which is to say, like, an artistic appreciation devoid of understanding of the function of this subject matter. Can you even imagine putting yourself in a state in which you could consider David's work outside of that context? And what would you see if you were looking at it not knowing it was Dugway Proving Ground, not knowing what that meant?
I think David made a comment in the presentation about, you know, it resembled the abstract art of other people. You know, and I didn't know the two individuals that you mentioned, but I can think about, we do find attraction to pattern, you know, that as, you know, as when, so that art, which, you know, is provided without context, you know, we can still appreciate. And a lot of what we're looking at is how things fit together within that space that's on the canvas, or in the case of this, sometimes, you know, on the floor, you know, or in large, you know, large format photographs. And so, you know, I'm often, one of the things that I've been interested in as a scientist is, why do we even perceive beauty? What would be the point of aesthetics? You know, and, you know, why would an abstract design attract us at all? And yet, cultures have come up with these various kind of symbols, you know, and designs that matter to them, and that are repeated in art, and, you know, and repeated in products that they make. You know, and there, for some reason, this is something that we seem to be drawn to.
I was captivated by one particular piece that I really enjoyed, and it was because it's from an oblique perspective of an area where I have been many times, and roads that I have driven, and I've appreciated the parallelism that was there, but you have a view of the downwind grid and Target S taken from an oblique perspective, and I appreciated just the beauty of it, just being able to kind of take it in, and the way, in the large format that it's presented, that was fun. And your question is just kind of, if it was a fresh palette of my own brain looking at it, that's the one that I was drawn to. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And walking into that room, you know, with the grids, my first impression was that they were star charts, mm-hmm. you know, almost fractals from the ground projected upward, and they were exquisite, you know, and it reminded me of Rilke, Beauty is the Beginning of Terror. Mm-hmm. So again, it's holding these contradictions and paradoxes at once. And I also thought of Agnes Martin with her grid and the echoes there. But then I have to say, David, walking into the rapid fire images with music, mm-hmm. and the name of it is called?
Kidomos.
And maybe you could talk about where that name comes from. Mm. I couldn't stay there. For me, it became a series of seizures. Mm-hmm. And I thought, if I stay there any longer, I will have that effect. And to me, that's the power, being seized by art to where your body feels it. Mm-hmm. And I am changed by that experience. And that, to me, is embodied art. That if we were to stay long enough in the heart of what is happening there without protection, it is a seizure of our mind, our body, our imagination. And, you know, I love the image of the building that you projected, that, and it's white, it's bright, it attracts light, but it also extends the shadow. Mm-hmm. And so I think to be able to look at the positive that is happening there and also the shadow side, that you can't have one without the other. And that's what I saw. That, to me, was the deeper aesthetic that I'm leaving with.
Thank you. That's wonderful to hear. It, in a way, it was the goal of that piece. And Kidoimos, the title, is Greek for the din of battle. But it came to me from an experience I had on my first trip to Dugway, where I was happened to be there at the time when they were doing a basically almost like a trade show at the site of Dugway, where civilian companies could pitch their technologies to the military and use Dugway as essentially a proving ground to perhaps sell their technology to the military, or use Dugway as a site to develop that technology. The press packet for that event was called Sophos Eudoimos. I might be mispronouncing all of it, but it basically meant wisdom over the din of battle. So with that piece, I collaborated with Chris Kalmeyer, who's an amazing composer, sound artist, musician, to make an oral component that could correspond to this very intensely choreographed sequence of something like 50,000 aerial images of those test sites. And they're sequenced together in kind of rapid fire succession. And we do warn viewers that if they are prone to seizure, they might want to be careful as to how long they spend or if they even go into that encounter. It grew out of my feeling that even with the enormous scale of those gridded pieces on the wall, those pieces printed on aluminum that are 10 by 10 feet, there was actually a limit to what still photography could do, that it wasn't fully descriptive of the potency of what's happening in that landscape. And that in order for me to try to access that, I had to work in a different arena than I had before. And it's that rapid fire succession, which in some ways is somewhat parallel to what it's like to work from the air when you're in a constantly moving vehicle in the sky, leaning out of the window with the wind blowing, and I'm looking through the lens, I'm hand-holding this camera, and time and space are kind of getting strung together, and as I'm making exposures, not that I'm shooting that rapidly, but it has that feeling of pulling something out of the wild, you know, that to see this kind of constantly shifting series of potential framings and potential kind of offerings, how you extract from that, that's something that sort of I was hoping to, in a way, convey with that video piece.
Nobody is able to say that name right, by the way. We all just called it SK.
SK. Just so you know. The SK Challenge.
They called it SK Challenge, yes. Yeah. And it was used, essentially a large effort can be very expensive. So we would host a lot of universities and other companies that would want to come in, and they get their early look at things. They get a challenge, and then they can try and look and see how well they're able to develop them and come up with better technologies and improve those things. And so that was kind of a, hey, here's a pooled resource. All comers kind of come in and be able to participate in that. And
so it's like a trade show.
No, it was a common test bed. So we would provide a common set of experiences, and we would provide all the referee data. So everybody who had a standoff detector or an identifier or something that would be an optical way of measuring or gathering information. And they'd say, well, our detector says this, when we could say, well, our detectors, the ground truth data is this. And they go, aha, well, we can see where we can make some improvements, tweaks, or hey, we're pretty close, or whatever. So that it kind of helped spur technology. And that's what the purpose was, is to help move technology forward and give ground truth information to a common challenge.
So testing for chemicals in the air, or what's the technology for example?
Good question. Let me work up to the answer. Part of what we would do is either use a simulant, either out of doors or in a facility we call the Joint Ambient Breeze Tunnel. It's a building, it's a tenth of a mile long, it's about 30 feet tall, and it allows us to characterize it using ambient air, but be able to have a diffused capability, well characterized, of a particle cloud coming through, so they'd be able to use light detection and ranging, LIDAR, or some other optical device to be able to say, hey, from a kilometer away, what's there?
And there's something in the air.
There's something in the air there. And we're using a simulant. It may be kaolin powder. It may be a non-pathogenic bacteria, spore-forming, for example, something like that. So we're using a simulant in those situations. They're interrogating that cloud with whatever detector that they may have, and we're able to provide them the corresponding ground truth information, either through a point detection or our own light detection and ranging information. Sometimes we do that in one of the grids that you will see in David Mizell's exhibit. And what's really fascinating is that all of that is really keyed on a meteorological basis of information. you're the unwitting consumers of meteorological information produced by Dugway Proving Ground. At over 100 towers and a variety of very small portable weather information display systems that are collecting wind speed and direction and relative humidity, all of that that's coming through is fed into university, not my alma mater, south of here. And and also that goes into the national airspace. If we do a weather balloon or something like that, that information is fed into the national weather database, and it's used to provide better weather information here locally and as well as nationally. But it's that body of information of weather data that allows us to make a predictive model so that we can then say, hey, look, this is where we're going to instrument. And also it provides us the go, no-go criteria to be able to know where that's going to end up, but to be able to then create a cloud, give them the background information of where that cloud's then going to go, and then also all of that data set that comes with it to be able to improve and test their own technologies. So all of those things are coming together. And the benefit that then comes out of that as well is that we're using that real-time data to then further improve the models that then we'll create. So there's a lot going on. It's pretty exciting. I love it. There's some really neat things that happen there, and it adds to an overall body of knowledge and it helps improve technology.
It's not really unlike what artists do, right? We come into a common experience and then we put our own eyes to it and our own approaches to it to try to make sense of it. This is what you both do in your own artwork, right?
Yeah, I suppose.
I mean, I do think it's an interrogation of ideas. Hmm. But again, I keep thinking they're false equivalents in a way. My pen, you know, I mean, it's a pen, it's a pencil, it can be erased, no one reads it. It's not going to harm someone. It's to illuminate, it's not, I hope, although I have to say, you know, maybe what I've written has harmed some people in my family. But we're talking about war. We're talking about people. You know, we're talking about countries and power and secrecy, and I think that can't be abstracted.
And toxins.
Yeah.
And toxins mm-hmm. that get released.
And that are going to be here for thousands of years, you know, in a place like the Nevada test site. There's a reason why you're in restricted airspace, right?
Well, there's actually several reasons why.
You know, so good point.
Mostly so that people don't wander into a jet that comes by. By the way, I'm not going to reveal any classified information, but you asked for a secret. You're going to love this one. The air traffic control tower at Michael Army Airfield, empty. Hasn't been used in years and years and years and years. All the air traffic control is done by the Air Force somewhere else off the installation. And, you know, and now allowing the Air Force to do their work there, that's the restricted airspace aspect of that. They're flying fast. They're doing all of the different military things that they need to do. And that doesn't coincide with airliners just coming by.
There's a whole drone program at Dugway
there,
as well.
There is. The program manager for the Army for unmanned aircraft systems has a component at Dugway Proving Ground known as the Rapid Integration and Acceptance Center. And part of what happens there is for specific unmanned aircraft that are going to be flown in theater, after it's made, they send it to Dugway and they do all the verification that is it going to work, and they fly it and do all the performance systems checks, and then they can box it up and send it to where it can be used. So all of that is done there. And they're looking for other things there for rapid integration of newer technologies, a better muffler, for example, or something, a better pitch for a wing. It could be anything, but what they're looking to do to improve those technologies, and flying that over your house to see if it flies or crashes. They need a place to be able to do that, and so that's how they do that.
If you just joined us, we are presenting on UPR Presents a panel discussion titled Utah's Proving Ground, Aesthetics, Environment, and Politics of Dugway Proving Ground. That was presented by the Nora Eccles Harrison Museum of Art at USU on October 23rd. We recorded this panel discussion as it originated from the USU Performance Hall. The panel for this panel discussion is comprised of photographer David Maisel, author Terry Tempest Williams, along with Mark Brunson, environmental ecologist at USU, and Vincent Lydiard, chief of staff at Dugway Proving Ground. The moderator is Matthew LaPlante, a USU journalism professor and host of Undisciplined on Utah Public Radio.
We need to turn to questions. I wanted to give Mark the opportunity to have a final word on what you've heard in this discussion. You've been a little quiet over there.
Yeah, and it's partly because we're moving outside of areas that I know very much about. Something struck me, all the way as we've been having this discussion and as I'm preparing and thinking about this topic for the last few days, I've been thinking about how what we do as humans is more different in terms of scale of impact than it is relative to other species. So, you know, David mentioned toxins, and I immediately thought of frogs and insects are using toxins for territorial defense or for attack purposes to achieve their ends. Altering the environment is something that, you know, that is not uncommon to species. It would be wonderful if all of us, our territorial defense was done the way that songbirds do it. But unfortunately, we haven't evolved in that direction.
That's a lovely final word.
That's awesome.
I would love to offer y'all the opportunity to ask a few questions. I think we have a little bit of time. Is that correct? Okay, and there is a microphone floating around somewhere out here.
Hi. I don't know how to phrase this as a question, but growing up in Salt Lake as a child, like, I was terrified of the Dugway Proving Grounds because we'd always hear in school that, you know, during the Cold War, we were going to be the first that would have all the radiation and stuff. And my great uncle was a sheep herder. And he would always tell stories about when, in the winter, when they take the sheep to the West Desert and about the big sheep kill. And he would also describe the beauty of the desert out there. But it was always such a terrifying thing. And I wonder how you can address the transparency thing, or, as Terry says, this compartmentalization. Because as we grew up, the pervasive culture was not to question, obey, obedience, and this is just how it was. You know, we were a target. And so if you could address, you know, that there has been some trauma or, you know, fear inflicted because of the lack of transparency or understanding or even, you know, letting the children know exactly what's going on. As our relatives are dying of cancer and we don't know where it's from and stuff. So I guess that's...
Maybe shortly, so we have more time for questions, but how do you consider your responsibility for as much transparency as possible while also acknowledging the fact that there's a lot you can't be transparent about? There's a duality there that's difficult to balance, yeah?
Yeah, so... differing now from 1968, the event you're referring to, I'm here. I think that kind of helps show you what some of those differences are. In some ways, I could have put my head in the sand, but many thanks, Katie, not only dedicated and passionate, but willing to kind of pursue these things. Many thanks, Katie. But being here, and my public affairs office are probably going to kill me, but this is part of what we're doing. Part of outreach, part of talking to people. I think in many cases, for myself, I think we fear what we don't understand. We've got folks at Dugway who go, you know what, I wouldn't go over to that building. Why? Well, you talk to people in that building, and they're like, what's the big deal? Come in, we'll show you. Look, this is what's here and what we work with. And when you take the unknown, when you ask the questions, it really helps. So I'm here to be able to say, here's what we can talk about. Here's some good things to talk about. Here's some things. I love some of the comments that Mark has made, and I'll try and keep it short. There is a desire to be able to have a transparency and provide information. We do that in the environmental work that we do. We believe to be good stewards of the environment and capturing what we are going to do, the deliberate nature of why. And again, I'm talking from a contemporary, what's happening now. And so there is information that is available. We are in the nethermost part of Utah. There is a scary fence that's there. But Dugway Proving Ground is made up of people who are trying to do the right thing. They're eager to participate, and they're staunch defenders of doing what is right. And so that information does exist. There is information that is available. By and large, most of what we do is not that classified. There's a lot of information that is available.
We have time for one more question.
Questions for David. As a young man, I was a wildland firefighter, and I had the dubious honor of actually scouting fires on the Dugway Proving Ground from the north end, and walking through the night, sometimes with others, sometimes alone, kind of going miles into the proving ground following a fire. And it's an amazing experience, as this woman suggests. It's an incredible landscape. And I was wondering if you ever had the opportunity, rather than to fly over, to actually get down on the ground and just walk and get a sense for the place and the landscape.
Sure. It's an extraordinary place. Absolutely. It is. There's a lot about it that's physically magnetic, absolutely magnetic. The mountains are magnetic. The vistas are exhilarating. And yet, it's not set apart as to be a nature preserve. That's not its function, really. Can a site be beautiful and also be damaging at the same time? Without a doubt. I didn't set out to make a body of work about the natural beauty of Dugway. That wasn't my intent. Another photographer perhaps would have pursued it that way. You know, there are wild mustangs on the site. There's tremendous beauty there, and I don't, in a way, question that. To me, what's interesting is that a place can be complex, that the beauty can be there as well as the difficult issues that arise from that place, that those things can coexist.
David and Terry have books available. They, I understand, are willing to sign those books. Please join me in thanking fascinating, diverse panel.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you. Thanks.
You've been listening to UPR Presents, and today we have presented a panel discussion titled Utah's Proving Ground, Aesthetics, Environment, and Politics of Dugway Proving Ground. That was presented by the Nora Eccles Harrison Museum of Art. It happened on Wednesday, October 23rd at USU's Performance Hall. Thanks so much for joining us today for UPR Presents.